oh gosh, we buried probably close to 400 gallons of water. So it took us 10 days just to bury stuff a month before we went out. We buried all that stuff in May and June. And so, you know, we're out in the middle of the desert, just outside the border, as we would dive in and out. And, you know, we're out there digging, and sometimes we'd be out there until midnight digging these. It looked like we were digging graves to drop water in. You know, we had to be very particular about, and we'd sort of triangulate so we could find these, because you could walk right by them or right over the top of them and you couldn't find them. So we knew exactly where they were. So that was part of the challenge, but we were able to pull it off, actually do a self-supported 425-mile circumnavigation of Death Valley in July. And, you know, there were times, there was one time in particular where it damn near killed me, where we ran out of water. So it's not something I'd suggest.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. Hello, my guest this week is Marshall Ulrich. He was recommended to me by the Bargo Brothers from episode 89. When I talked to them at the end of the episode, they says, "Hey, you know, you really ought to call Marshall. He is the real life Forrest Gump." And after my conversation with Marshall, I tend to believe what the Bargo Brothers said about him. Marshall has run a lot of ultramarathons. He's done he's done things more than running. He has participated in every single Echo Challenge adventure race that they've ever held. The latest one of those was in Fiji. You might have seen it on Amazon, called the World's Toughest Race. Bear Gillis, I believe, is the one who is the host of it. He was on one of the teams that was in that race, but he's also been in every one of them. So if you can remember the Echo Challenge from back when Discovery Channel was doing it, he was in there in those races as well. He has also run across the United States, which kind of reminds me of what Forrest Gump was doing. Marshall has also run the Badwater 135. Well, actually, he said he always does it 145, I believe. The Badwater Marathon always stops at the parking lot and does not go into the nature trail. But he has always gone to the top. He's run Badwater from 20 times. He set the course record and won the race for 2 years back-to-back in the early days of the race. He has got all kinds of fun stories, interesting experiences. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Marshall Ulrich. Well, hey, I appreciate it. Yeah, the Bargo Brothers told me when I had a conversation with them, and Bargo Brothers says, "Hey, you know, you really ought to talk to Marshall." And so I was like,
"Oh, yeah. Yahoos."
Yeah, I had you on my list of, and I was like, "Oh, you know, I never did get a hold of you." So, I appreciate you making time to talk to me.
So. Well, yeah, it's my pleasure. The Bargo Brothers. Yes, they wanted to go up. I guess it was Albert in Leadville, and I asked them what time of the year they wanted to do it, and they said, "Oh, you know, let's do it in like February or whatever." And I said, "You do realize that there's going to be about, you know, 7 or 8 feet of snow up there toward the top." So anyhow, the wind was just horrendous. I don't know if you saw that clip, but they cut a lot of it out. I literally got blown back off my feet and hit my head on a rock.
Oh my goodness.
Just about knocked me out. So anyhow, it was a nasty, nasty day. And those guys, they're always running on such a low budget. It's like, "No, we got to do this because we can't afford to go up again."
Yeah.
So they're quite funny, but I kind of wonder if they're going to, how long they're going to survive in this world.
Well, I saw their, I didn't see their episode with you. I mean, I saw, yeah. I talked to them and they told me, and I saw their interview with you at, on YouTube, the little short one you did in Leadville. But I didn't see their episode with you climbing, but yeah, I saw their, when they did the Denali, they climbed Denali and then they, you know, bicycled down the coast. And there's stories about being in the snow cave and almost freezing to death. Like they seem to, they kind of push the edge of.
Sometimes.
Yeah. But if, you know, that's, you know, I admire that. That's, so many of us, I think, are afraid to take any kind of risk, and so they kind of compensate for it.
Yeah, they're on the other end of the spectrum for sure.
Yeah. Well, I usually try to start out by talking to. I've read a little bit about your bio, usually I start out for people who may not know who you are. Give kind of a brief summary of how did you get started running, Marshall? Yeah.
So I got started running. This was, you know, way back in the 80s, and my wife was diagnosed with cancer, and so I started running more for health because. My blood pressure was way, way up and I didn't have any way to control it, other than either exercise or they gave me the option of putting me on some sort of drug or whatever. And so I said, nope, I don't want to do that. So I started running in the 80s and then just sort of expanded, the distances as, I found that, you know, it would keep me sane, number one. And the other thing is I seem to be pretty good at it. The longer the distances, the better I was at it.
Uh-huh. So did you start off on roads? I mean, that was...
Yeah, I started out just doing 5 and 10Ks. And, you know, shortly thereafter, within a year, I started doing marathons. And I guess it was, I don't know, 4 or 5 years later, back in about, you know, the mid 80s, I started doing ultra marathons. And they were mostly, you know, road ultra marathons and then a lot of trail. So within a couple of years, I started doing a lot of trail running. And I actually preferred that and have probably done more of that than anything else. Although, you know, I have done some, you know, 24 hours on track and stuff like that, which at that time, I felt it was fine because you could just go around in a circle and you had everything you needed. But then it is a little bit monotonous. I didn't seem to mind it then. But the older I got, the more I liked getting out and connecting with nature. And the best way to do that is to get out and do a trail.
Mm-hmm. So what trail race? I mean, back in the 80s, there were some trail races there, but no, not like they were, not like they are now. So what were some of the races that you did started on? What were your first ones?
Well, I started with Western States actually, and I think that was probably 1987. And then, you know, right away and jumped in and I did Leadville. Those two, of course, were around. And then there was Wasatch and Angeles Crest. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the Grand Slam. That's the 4 100s and. Mm-hmm. You know, people started doing that for a challenge. They were spaced, I don't know, 3 to 6 weeks apart. And then they have what they call the Last Great Race. And actually, I think that was named after an event. Well, I did the only six 100s there were, all of the six 100s there were in 1989. And so I was the first to do that.
Wow.
And they called Last Great Race. So let's see if I can remember what they were. They were, Vermont was brand new. There was Old Dominion. There was Leadville. There was Wasatch, Angeles Crest. And what am I missing? Did I say Western States? Anyhow, it was the major ones. And that's all there were at that time. Now you've got, what, 100 to 200?
Oh, my, yes. They're everywhere.
Yeah, they're everywhere. But there were only six at the time. And so I decided I wanted to do those. And I think I did those. They were spaced almost exactly an average of 3 weeks apart. Did pretty well with them. I think I finished in the top 10 in 5 of the 6. So, you know, I was running at a very competitive level then.
Mm-hmm. So what was the running community like? I mean, for those of us who have, you know, recently discovered ultramarathons, you know, the last sometimes even the last decade, there seemed to be like a big growth of it. What was it like back then when you were running? What were races organized like?
Yeah, the races were pretty well organized. Take, for instance, Western States. I think they even had a lottery back then because I was fortunate to have gotten into Western States, I think, 6 consecutive times. And then the 7th time I didn't get in, I just didn't do it. But like Leadville did not have a lottery, and you usually had 200 to 300 people doing that. So it was a smaller group of people. Old Dominion probably had about the same number. And I don't think it had any sort of requirement to get in. So it was a little bit smaller, and you had Ultra Running Magazine, which I think the readership was, way less than 10,000. And now you have tens of thousands of people that are doing that. So it was a lot more low key. And I like to think, we were out there just doing it for the challenge. We didn't care about the notoriety or anything like that. Not that there was none then, and there's very little now, although you do hear about it more and more, but it's become much more mainstream. Back then, we were kind of looked at as, it was a bit unusual. We were a little bit, I don't want to say freakish or whatever, but, people just didn't quite understand why we're out there doing that, and it just didn't make a whole lot of sense to them. So, but we didn't really care because we were out there just doing it for the love of running, and we just wanted to, push the limits and see what we could do.
So I was curious, what was the relationship between the road runners and the trail runners? Were the road running community even aware that, people ran trails?
Not so much. It was there. Take, for instance, you had the Pikes Peak Marathon. And incidentally, mm-hmm. The Pikes Peak Marathon is the second oldest marathon in the United States behind Boston.
Wow,
so it's been around for a long time. Yeah. So, it's been around. People would seek, that sort of thing out as long as, they wanted to. The shorter distances, I don't remember there being a lot of them, but there were like half marathons, marathons. There were on trails, but it's certainly not as popular as it is now. I mean, it's just absolutely exploded, and it's, people, I can see why it's very popular because, I like to say that it connects us, it kind of brings us back to our roots and really grounds us and things like that. So, I can see why people are attracted to that. Running on the road, I was pretty good at it. I ran across the United States, and of course that was all on road, and that beat, it's a little bit more unforgiving, and I don't prefer that, although I can do it. But trails, they really can have a healing effect on us all, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So what was the led up to you deciding to run across the United States?
I had wanted to run across the United States way back in the 1990s. There were a couple of transcontinental runs. I think it was 92, 93. And I was actually entered in those. And they were an international event. They had Al Howie from Canada, who has passed away. It's been 10 years since he's passed away. But there were guys like that. And, it was a small group of people once again. And I had entered that, but I was just too involved in my business, and I was trying to raise kids and things like that. I was, bumping up into my 40s as far as age is concerned. So, I was just way too busy with life, and so I couldn't do it. And so I didn't really officially get around to doing it until 2008, which was, 18 years later when I was 57 years old. So, it's like anything else, sometimes you have to put things on the back burner decades before you get them done. But, if you really want to do them, you usually get around to doing them.
Right. So the races in the 90s were official, like they were competitive races. And did you just decide then to do it like on your own?
Yeah, they were competitive races. Those were stage races. The one when I decided to do it, there's a documentary out there. It's called Running America, which you can get, I believe, I don't know if you can get it on Netflix, but You know, I think it's out there. If you do a search for it, you can see it, and I think you can actually I think you can get it on iTunes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's the only place. But it's called Running America, and it was it was pretty much a big time production, in that I don't know if you've ever heard of it was produced by the people who put together Sling Blade Group, and I had four or five people following me, as well as Charlie Engel. Charlie Engel had to drop out when we got into Utah. He had some injuries, but I was able to succeed going across. And so, you know, that essentially took me 52 days at 57 years old. And I was averaging about just under 60 miles per day for 52 days straight.
Wow. So you talked about doing that. And you also had, you did 24-hour races. How did you kind of keep yourself going? What did you say? What did you tell yourself to be able to get up each day and do that?
Yeah, you know, the beauty of 24 hours is you don't have to think a whole lot when you're out there. You can just put one foot in front of the other. And, you know, I'm kind of a daydreamer, and so I can just let my mind drift and go places, you know, and check in and think about my family, or, you know, think about how I'm doing, you know, with my running. So, you know, it's kind of a mindless thing to do, whereas take, for instance, a 100-mile trail run, you're more focused, and I think time might go a little bit quicker just because you're having to concentrate on, you know, your footwork and things like that. But yeah, in my first book, I talk about it a little bit, and I came up with a terminology, and I call it time compression. And I think the more you run, the better you get at it, where time just seems to fly by. It goes quickly. You can be out there running 10 hours, and it can be compressed, and you can think of it as maybe being out there only 3 or 4 hours. And so it's kind of, I don't know if you want to call it a meditation, but the more you do it, the better you get at it. And, you know, I think that's, you can kind of check out of life too for a while and just concentrate on something very simplistic.
Yeah. So do you take your mind, kind of away, or is it more of a focusing on the present? I know it's because a lot of runners talk about their discipline is to kind of be in the moment and to be present.
Well, I think it helps to be in the moment at times, but then once again, I would relate it to more of a meditative state or something like that, where being in the moment doesn't even exist. I mean, you're just going down the road and not thinking about anything in particular and just letting your mind drift from one thing to another. So it's more of, you're not so conscious as you would be and focused in the real world. So, you know, it's just an escape of sorts, I guess, is the best way to describe it. And being in the moment does help. But I don't know if it's necessary. If it's an accumulation of, you know, a number of steps, well, then, you know, it makes it more palatable, because if you think about, gosh, I've got to take 100,000 steps in order to, you know, go this 10 miles or something like that, it'd drive you nuts. You know, you just think, you know, it's going to take a bunch of steps, and that's just the way it is. And so, you know, accepting, being very accepting about it.
Yeah. And I think people use that term being in the moment to kind of try to describe meditation, you know, meditative state. I think the terminology may be talking about the same kind of thing as you're talking about, is that that you're not projecting into the future. You're really not worried about anything. You're just kind of there and letting things flow. And
that's really true. I sort of enjoy when I'm out there thinking of myself as being very, very insignificant. You know, the universe is a big place, and so we're just a little tiny speck in the universe. And so I like that idea of being very small and almost, vanishing into the universe instead of, being, it being so much about you and other people paying attention to you or you paying attention to all sorts of things, but just sort of, slipping through space, in a finite way. I'm getting a little bit etherical here, but
yeah, that's what mindset is very much, very much in that. Yeah. So you were running across the United States. That was then kind of later, or you'd done a lot more running, from your early days. You'd done quite a few more ultra marathons since before you started the running across the United States then.
Yeah. Before I ran across the United States, I imagine I'd probably done at least 120 ultra marathons that would have averaged at that time, maybe 125 miles each. So, it was a significant amount of ultra running. And in 1995, I also got involved in the Eco Challenges adventure racing. In fact, our team Stray Dogs just finished a race a couple of years ago, and it was the Eco Challenge. It's called the World's Toughest Race in Fiji. So we had a team in Fiji, and in fact, that's featured on Amazon Prime. It's a 10-part series. Mark Burnett is the producer, and Bear Grylls is the one who is sort of the face or the host of that show. And it featured, I don't know, about 100 teams altogether. So I really got into the adventure racing. And I don't know if you know much about adventure racing, but that's usually courses of, say, 400 miles. And there's a team of four or five people. It's usually four people. There has to be one woman. You do different disciplines, mountain biking, paddling, sometimes horseback riding. There's a lot of climbing involved and rope work, and it can have different disciplines. We did one in Morocco where we rode camels, and that was one segment of it. So it can vary wildly as far as the disciplines, but it's go as you please also. So it's the first one to the finish, and so that 300-400 miles would sometimes take us up to anywhere from 5 days to maybe 2 weeks. There were some of the adventure races that I did. They were called Raid Galois instead of the Eco Challenge, the French version, and they were as long as 500 miles and would last a couple of weeks. So I started getting into the adventure racing, which allowed me to also do the mountaineering. And so I kept doing the adventure racing while I was doing all the ultra running. It didn't do much for my speed, but I just liked changing it up a little bit, because ultra running can be very tedious at times, and it was just something else to another challenge, if you will. And in some places like New Zealand, Patagonia, where we raced, we would be up, and in British Columbia, we'd be up, traveling, roped up, traversing glaciers and doing mountaineering and things like that that were involved in the race. And so I got into mountaineering, and which eventually led to there was a couple of years, 2002 to 2004, where I was able to do the Seven Summits and Everest and stuff like that. So, once again, it was sort of changing things up, another challenge. And, I get very impatient and bored with things, and so I like to have something fresh going on, and something that I would like to say is creative.
Mm-hmm. And I know that the Eco Challenge is the adventure race that a lot of people are familiar with, but there are also, there's a guest I had on the podcast a while back, she's talked about their shorter adventure races as well. So that's adventure racing is, it covers the whole, it's kind of like running. I mean, there are shorter distances and things that are accessible to, to everybody really, rather than the long challenges.
So they call the shorter distance, adventure races. Sometimes they're 24 hours, 48 hours, something like that. They call those sprint distance. And I did a couple of those, yeah. but very few of them. So the longer ones were called expedition. That was more expedition adventure racing. So there is kind of a terminology, but you're absolutely right. There's different distances, just as there would be with running.
What is the dynamic like in the team aspect of that? I mean, you have five different personalities. Well, is your team, the one that you're with, have they, and I think you're the one who's done all of the echo challenges. Is your team been together for quite a while? So you know each other, or how does that dynamic work with the?
Absolutely. I mean, our team, we started way back in Utah with the first Eco Challenge, and that was in 1995. And we still, we were racing in Fiji together. Mark Macy was on a different team with his son, and Mark has Alzheimer's. He was diagnosed at 64 years old. So there's Mark Macy, there's Bob Ha, and he's one of the original, what we call our team Stray Dogs, and we are the oldest adventure racing team, the cohesive racing team on the planet. So we've been together. We do things together even now. We're very connected. We know each other very, very well. We would generally have women that would come in and race for us, two or three or four times. They were fantastic too. So sometimes what you'll see with the old eco challenges is they'll focus in. And by the way, Mark Burnett, of course, is the producer of Survivor. So Survivor actually sprung from the eco challenges. So Mark Burnett started doing, Survivor. And what I was going to say is Survivor focuses on some of the dysfunction that happens between people, because those are interesting stories. That's what people want to see. But our team was pretty boring because we always got along. We just have great admiration for each other. We help each other. It's very much different. And I think the complexion of the Eco Challenge, the filming, they touched upon a little bit of that early on and throughout probably the first eight or so of the Eco Challenges, which were on the Discovery Channel, USA Channel. But this last one, which is on, as I mentioned, on Amazon Prime, they focused on more of the compassionate, empathetic side of things. So you'll see our team Stray Dogs, in that production actually featured, because we were all, our goal was not only to race as Team Stray Dogs, but to help Mark Macy and his team with Travis Macy, his son. We worked in conjunction with each other, and our emphasis was mostly on Mark and his Alzheimer's, which is, it's a very touching story. It came to a better place. I think it's evolved also, where it got away from all of that, strife and arguing and bickering, and really got into what I think humanity should be all about.
Yeah. Yeah. And the group dynamic is always, I mean, that's always, I would imagine, a challenge. I remember I saw some of the, I watched the one on Amazon, the Eco Challenge on Amazon. And it is a very good story. And they did seem to focus on the personalities within the team, and the people there who were looking to really stretch themselves beyond what they thought was possible.
Sure.
And the physical challenge. I know the going up, there was a one they had to go, wade up the river that was extremely cold, and people were having hypothermia. And there was a lot of that. So we'll continue the conversation with Marshall in just a minute. But first, I want to take a second to tell you about a special offer that I have. I have created a short video course called How to Crush Your Goals. You remember all of those resolutions that you have left over from January? You probably put somewhere in a closet in the back of your mind? Why not pick one of those resolutions, take it out, dust it off, and let's get it done this year? You still have a lot of time left in 2022. Why not just decide to make that a year of success, of actually getting a goal or two that you have crushed, and you can come to the end of the year feeling like you've gotten something done. The link to this course is on the show notes page, ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can enter the code podcast, that's podcast in all capital letters, at checkout, and you get a 20% discount. This is a short course, no fluff, no filler, just the stuff that you need to do to be able to get some stuff done, to crush your goals. This is the same kind of tools that I offer to my one-to-one clients, and you can have them for a great substantial discount. Check it out at ultramindsetpodcast.run. So you've also done Badwater, and you did Badwater back when it was longer. What was the change? When did they change that?
So Badwater was, very small and, high tech. The footwear company was the one who actually turned that into a race. It was just more of a, good old boy crossings for the most part, but they turned it into a actual race. I believe it was in 1988. And so in 1990, that's where I made my first appearance down at Badwater, and I believe there were 12 or 14 participants back then. And incidentally, the you'd never guess how much the entry fee was. It was $12. Yeah. And of course, high tech, you had to qualify for it. So you had to, have some pretty good credentials to get into it even back then. But what they would do is they would even comp, or they would forgive that as long as you signed up and you had good credentials. They wouldn't even charge you the $12. And here's the flip side of it. Back then, there were a couple of years where I set records out there, and so what they would do is, and won it, of course. What they would do is, it would, you'd win $1,000 if you won it, and then if you set a new record, you got $1,000 bonus. And then I think the second year I ran it, I did the same thing. I won it and set, even bettered my own record. And they were so impressed that they gave me, $1,000 plus a couple of $1,000 bonus because, I broke my own record. So things are a lot different now. But, it was just a lot of fun and very, very low key. Essentially, what they do is they'd start you at Badwater and shoot the gun off and away you'd go. And we'll see you at the end. No checkpoints, nothing. So it was on your word. And of course, people were very good about, keeping within the rules, although there weren't a whole lot. And even as far as cars that were out there, sometimes the entire race, we'd see a half dozen cars. So, it was back where, I have fond memories of that, and it's changed a lot. It's gotten a little bit more commercial and stuff, and it's still very challenging, but it stops at the 135 miles at the portals, and there's a reason for that, because above the portals, to get up to the top of Whitney, you're in wilderness area, so they really can't run a race there. But anytime I've done the race, I've done the actual race 20 times. I have always gone to the top in keeping with, lowest to highest in the Western Hemisphere. So it's changed a lot. And that 146 miles, everybody, the first couple of years, everybody prided themselves in getting up to the top. And that was the real finish, although, it was a hush-hush thing. You couldn't really announced that you were going up to the top. You had to just kind of sneak up there, take all your race numbers off, and because you're in wilderness area. But we always kept our times.
So was the wilderness area was closed just closed to organized events?
It's closed to organized events. That's right. You cannot have an organized event in a wilderness area. Yeah, and that's kind of interesting because you think about, well, let's see. I don't know, like Denali and stuff like that. They're talking about, I don't know. So yeah, wilderness area, it's just a whole different ball game where, you know, they try and limit the traffic, they try and limit people, and they want to keep it as pristine as possible, and that's their way of doing it.
Well, and I've heard Grand Canyon was similar. There were people who did unorganized races on the Grand Canyon, and the parks didn't parks worked to kind of quash that.
Yeah, I could see that. I've done rim to rim to rim, I don't know, three times or so, and you know, we just go out and do it. And I didn't realize, did they have some sort of a race that was planned out there?
No, it was unsanctioned. And so it was an underground. It was an underground. That you had to know whoever group, you had to be a part of their list, and they just all showed up out there and raced. And the parks, I guess, have worked to, you know, root those out and make sure that people aren't doing it. It was on a podcast about. Davy Crockett, the podcaster on History of Ultra, was talking about the Grand Canyon, and he talked about groups that had, and I'm not sure exactly when it was, but I know that at one time that was becoming a regular thing, and the parks have worked to get that. But again, it was like, it can't be an organized event.
Yeah, I get it. I know Davy, you know, pretty well from his work and stuff, and. You know, his website and everything, he always has just very well researched articles. So he'd be the go-to guy to know whether or not it's sanctioned or not, for sure.
Yeah. And then you also did a circumnavigation of Death Valley, or was that?
Yeah. So, you know, that's in keeping, you know, I had mentioned that I like to create things, you know, events and things that had never been done. And, you know, it's always challenging. But I had a good friend. His name was Dave Heckman. And he was a medic or on the medical team out in Death Valley. And he had kind of pestered me for 2 or 3 years. And he says, "Marshall, we need to go out and do a circumnavigation of Death Valley." And I kept saying, "No, I don't think I want to do that." Because, of course, you know, it's got to be in July or August. And, or so I told him. I said, you know, if we're going to do it, we've got to do it right. And I'm not interested in doing it because it's just it'd be too brutal. But finally, he convinced me to do it. And so we laid the groundwork for that. And what we did is we buried over a dozen caches, and they were about 12 miles. There was an intermediate cache with just water. And then at the end of the day, which is about a marathon to, 50K, there would be another stash where we would actually sleep during the night. And we went around the perimeter diving in and out of the border of Death Valley. And it took us 16 and a half days. And, oh gosh, we buried probably close to 400 gallons of water. So it took us 10 days just to bury stuff a month before we went out. We buried all that stuff in May and June. And so, you know, we're out in the middle of the desert, just outside the border, as we would dive in and out. And, you know, we're out there digging. And sometimes we'd be out there until midnight digging these. It looked like we were digging graves to drop water in. So, you know, we had to be very particular about, and we'd sort of triangulate so we could find these, because you could walk right by them or right over the top of them and you couldn't find them. So we knew exactly where they were. So that was part of the challenge, but we were able to pull it off, actually do a self-supported, 425 mile circumnavigation of Death Valley in July. And, you know, there were times, there's one time in particular where it damn near killed me, where we ran out of water. So it's not something I'd suggest.
Yeah, I can imagine. So, and you buried the stuff. Did you then have like a marker or something so you could find it, or was it just like you had to?
Well, we hit our GPS, and then what we do is, like, if there's mesquite bushes or something like that or rocks, what we do is we'd take about a 20-foot, make a 20-foot triangle with, like, points where there were flag, you know, a little strip of flagging or something, or rocks that we place, so that we'd go into the center from that little triangulation. And amazingly, there were probably 90% of them. And, you know, the wind had blown over the top of them, and that water and food or whatever we had in those was about 4 inches underground or below the surface. You know, as I was saying, you couldn't even, you could walk right up to it and not see it, but we knew exactly where we buried them. We wouldn't have to fish around very long because, you know, even in the middle of the night, we kind of knew exactly where they were. So it's interesting how memory will serve you more correctly when you're in, you know, you have a stake in the game of finding it.
And I would imagine that, you know, that would be pretty important. I mean, that if you missed one and couldn't locate it, I mean, that was your very survival depended upon being able to find those.
Well, you know, there were two of them in particular, one of them that we found, and it just so happened that some of them were buried a little bit closer together than others. And there was one that we came upon, and we had buried the containers upside down and all the water had drained out of them. So we did find that one. But what we would do is we would carry about a half again more water just in case something happened where we could actually survive, you know, not having to use that one. And it just so happened that one, you know, we were okay with that. And then later on, I guess it was about the 14th day or something like that, we were not able to find another one. And once again, we had enough water available that we were able to make it to the next one. So we always had a little bit of a buffer. But then, you know, having said that, we were climbing out of Saline Valley and we had a short distance of maybe 8 or 10 miles. But then we had to climb up out about 6,000-7,000 feet out of the floor of Saline Valley, and we ran out of water, and we were pretty desperate, very desperate for water. So, you know, we actually didn't know if we were going to make it, but we finally did. And, you know, that was a tough one. It was a miscalculation because we had enough water. We just needed to carry more because going up those hills and everything, you know, we probably took 3 gallons each and we drank it all within the first, you know, half distance that we needed to go. And then there were times in the southern part going across the China Lakes, you know, weapons testing or whatever you call it, that area there where we'd have to go 30 miles, you know, in the heat of the summer. So we were carrying over 5 gallons of water each just to get across that 30 miles.
Wow. Yeah, I could see that. I could see that. That would that's amazing. So you've also written some books. Talk a little bit about what are your books you know, I have to offer. You've got Both Feet on the Ground. Is that a fairly recent book?
Yeah, Both Feet on the Ground. That was released about, I guess, a couple of years ago. And that is, let me back up just a little bit. I'll talk about Running on Empty, and that was released somewhere around, I don't know, 2011, something like that. And that was more about the run that I did across the United States and, you know, some of the other things that I did also. But the thread of it is pulled together by Running Across America, and it has a lot to do about Heather, my wife, and I, and, you know, the process, the difficulty that I had, you know, surviving the death of my wife. And so it's a very complex story, but it's not about running at all. People who get the book, it's not about running. It's more about life, and it's about learning to love again and things like that. So that came out in 2011, and then, the second book, both feet on the ground. People had said, you know, you don't talk about climbing Everest. You don't talk about, the Death Valley, circumnavigation and so on. So I thought, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to come out with this book. And it was just very apropos because what I was trying to do, the other emphasis for the book, other than telling those stories, was talking about reconnecting with nature. And of course, with COVID-19 and everything, it was, as I was saying, it was very apropos because that book came out when we were all cooped up inside. And so it was kind of a guidebook or, handbook for people, to encouraging them to get outside and connect with nature. And, that's how we're going to get through a lot of these tribulations that we're going through with COVID-19. And, sure enough, that's what's happened. Almost to the extent, we have one of these VRBO rentals up in the mountains, and I mean, it has just been packed since COVID-19. And it's because I think people are discovering that, they need to get outside, they need to get into nature to, for that healing process. So it's those two books, essentially, that are out there. And you can find them on Amazon. There's the audio form. There's the Kindle form of them. All three formats for both books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll put links to that in the show notes, so people can find them if they want to do that. So what is the kind of the thing that you've had a life of adventure? So what would you say is kind of the thing that's been the thing that's kept you going, looking for that, looking to continue to push yourself forward?
Well, I think we all have to have a purpose in our life. And I've done quite a bit of fundraising also. We originally raised quite a lot of money for the Religious Teachers Filipini, who help impoverished women, in places like Eritrea, Ethiopia, and educating, young girls and giving them jobs and teaching them trades and things like that. And right now, the most current thing is the Alzheimer's Association. And so, take for instance, my wife and I are going to go out and we're going to do a portion of the intact Route 66, which is about 159 miles, and we're going to go out another 10 days or so and travel that portion of Route 66, raising money for Alzheimer's. Last year, what I did is I did the first winter Badwater. So you think about Badwater, and of course, that's always in the summer. And I thought, well, nobody's ever done a winter Badwater. So the easy portion is the desert because it's maybe 75 degrees. But getting out up Mount Whitney took me 2.5 days because there was a lot of snow up there and it took mountaineering skills and so on. So we did that for Alzheimer's and we raised about over $15,000. And so we'll go out and do this for Alzheimer's. And, to answer your question, that's kind of my motivation now, reaching beyond, creating new things to do, plus doing something for society and making life meaningful. And so, it's more than about the running. It's more than about the adventure racing. It's connecting with humanity and doing something good for other people.
You've been doing this for a long time as well. What would you say to people who are like in their 40s, who are looking ahead and thinking that they only have a certain, they only have a certain limited time where they can be active?
Well, I'm 70 now. So, I think if they stay active, first of all, they don't have to be going out there doing some of the stuff that I do. I mean, you know, that's not realistic for a lot of people, nor it may not be healthy for them. Maybe their joints aren't holding up as well, or, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, I think, you know, to stay mentally healthy, I think it helps to be active. And I think we can keep doing things way beyond the years that we think we should be. You know, we can, you know, I look forward to doing things in my, you know, of course, in my 70s and in my 80s and beyond. So I would say to them, you know, don't sell yourself short. You can do way more than you think you can, and you can keep doing it way longer than you think you could. So, you know, keep getting out there, keep doing it, and it'll make you whole too. And find I think what it does too is if you weave it in with just staying healthy, take for instance, or being active enough to be able to do things with your grandkids or great grandkids or whatever, let that be a motivation. So, you know, I think it's all a part of living, and the more that we can keep challenging ourselves, keep focusing on other people, you know, I think the better off we are and the healthier we are mentally and physically.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate it. And tell people, where's the best places, if somebody hears this, where's the best place for them to connect with you and the things that you're doing?
They can just go to my website. It's marshallulrich.com. So, you know, it's very easy. Facebook. You can also go to, you know, my Facebook. You know, once again, Marshall Ulrich, and, you know, just I'm about the only one on it. And you can look for this new event that we're doing, you know, in a couple of weeks, too. And I'll have a tracker so you can watch my wife and I go along Route 66. It's out here by Lake Havasu, Kingman, you know, in that area out here, of course, on the old Route 66. And incidentally, that this portion of 66 in Arizona is the longest intact portion that's left in the United States. So it's pretty cool. So we'll have pictures that we'll be posting, and you can follow us. And if you're compelled to, you know, you can also donate to the Alzheimer's Association.
Okay. Okay. I appreciate that. Well, before you go, I have started a new thing on the podcast. It's called these the bridge questions. There are three random questions.
Who approaches the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, bridge keeper. I'm not afraid.
What is the weirdest thing you've seen when you've been out on the trails?
Wow, the weirdest thing I've seen. Besides myself. weirdest thing. I think, you know, in adventure racing, you know, we saw some python snakes and also some what they call cassowaries, which are kind of like an emu of sorts. And those little boogers can be very, very aggressive in that, you know, they can throw themselves at you and impale, you know, in your chest, their feet. You know, they've got little forked feet. So anyhow, you know, they can kill you. But anyhow, that's more detail than you want to know.
that would be an added challenge. If you get an aggressive animal that can kill you. Yeah, that's a okay. No, second question: What is a food that should be in every aid station?
probably, you know, some sort of greasy hamburger. Makes sense to me. Okay. And Coca-Cola. You know, people, you know, before Gatorade and all that other stuff was very popular, and we actually got the people of Western States to buy into it, you know, put Coca-Cola out there because it's sugary and it keeps you going and stuff like that. So, you know, it's very simplistic. And the other thing that's very important, you know, to keep you going and essential is, you know, a little bit of salt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Last question is what word or phrase would describe your philosophy of life?
Let's see. That's a good question. You know, I think it kind of goes along with, you know, doing more than you think you can, and doing it to just what I said, longer than you think you could, or yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Well, that's good. Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah. Well, thank you a lot, Marshall. I appreciate you taking time to talk with me, and I've enjoyed hearing about your adventures.
Well, and, thank you. Yeah.
Hopefully some people will be inspired to get out and do more.
Well, I certainly hope so. That's the name of the game, right? That's what keeps us young.
Right. it does. Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. You know, I say that every week at the end of the episode, but it truly is an honor to have you listen to this podcast. I appreciate you spending time with me and my guests each week. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you might recall I had a sponsor for a handful of episodes where I did ads at the beginning. Other podcasts have ads, and some of them have a lot of ads. And I thought, well, you know, I could recoup some of the cost of doing this podcast and putting it on if I started doing advertising too. But it didn't really quite feel right for me. When I listen to podcasts, when I listen to other podcasts, at the beginning, you know, I want to hear the show. And when I start listening to a podcast, I want to hear what's going on and get into who the guest is. And having to wait while the host reads the ads, and the sponsors, they want their ads right up front. So most of the hosts have to read the ads, you know, like right away in the show. And it just didn't feel right for me. I felt like it interrupts the flow of the show, and I decided, well, I'm not going to do that. I stopped looking for sponsors, but I am going to do something. I'm offering some products and services here on the show. You may have heard my ad for the my course, Crush Your Goals, in the middle of this episode. This course that I created is designed to give people simple tools for setting goals and getting them done. I used to struggle with this. I used to struggle with that for years. I'd set goals and they ended up being like resolutions. I just kind of let them slip away. This course is very, very simple, very no fluff. How to get your goal, how to set goals, how to choose how to set goals and actually get them done, crush them. There's also a bonus course as part of this, how to manage your cravings, because a lot of times the goals were, are about changing your habits and sometimes for losing weight. And you get these cravings that will actually help, will actually hinder you from your goals. And so I added that as a bonus course as well. This is the kind of mindset stuff that I teach and I deal and lead my clients through when I'm dealing with them one-to-one. But I know a lot of you who listen, you don't need to have a one-to-one. You need some, a little tune-up here and there. So that's why I created this course. And the thing I didn't do, I didn't cram this course full of fluff so that I'd make it, 5-6 hours long or longer so I could charge a whole lot of money for it. I made it straight to the point so I could charge, and I'm just charging $19 for the course, and you get 20% off when you use the code PODCAST. It's PODCAST, all capital letters. The checkout is a little bit particular about the fact whether it's capitalized or not. I will have other offers to talk about, but I've been talking about this for enough time, and you've been gracious to listen this long, and I appreciate it. Remember, it's ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can find the show notes for this show and all the rest of the shows. Also, there's a sidebar in those posts. If you look alongside where those show notes are, you will see a section there for comments, questions, and stories. You can leave a text, click, and you can leave a voice message. We'd be glad to hear your voice and have you talk back to me. You can also leave a text comment if you have something that you want to text to us. Enjoy comments, questions, and stories. Anything you have to say would be appreciated. And also, just below all of that, you will find links to the course that I mentioned. And as always, if you have enjoyed this episode, if you know somebody who would like to hear Marshall's stories and some of the adventures he went on, send if you know somebody who would like to hear it, send them a link, helps me grow the show, and appreciate it. People have been doing that. The show has been growing. I know more people are listening, and I really appreciate that, because the more people we have listening, the more kinds of things that I can do with the show. Remember that an ultramarathon mindset is what we're talking about here, and it helps with running, but it's about more than running. And I do life coaching to help you get unstuck. And if you want the course that I was talking about, could be a good start. But if you want something a little bit more in depth, and really want to get yourself into that epic life that you were looking for, give me a voice message here, ultramindset podcast.run, and leave me a voice message or send me a message. I'd be glad to get in touch with you and see if I can help you. Thanks again for listening. I will see you next time.